Well, that's the news from Haiti. And now on to the rest of the week's news.
If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down.
That was Missouri Senate candidate Todd Akin, whose comments shook up politics around the country, including right here in Massachusetts.
The people of Massachusetts have a choice. They can have someone who will always vote to support women.
There's a sense of desperation, and you've seen a lot of the distortions and once again misleading the voters about my position on issues.
Meanwhile, money, big money. MGM Resorts International unveils its $800 million proposal to build a casino in downtown Springfield.
We really want to help the city help itself.
Also, pushing for diversity, Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis wants to overhaul the department's promotion process. But the Association of Minority Officers and other observers say changing a test won't affect what really needs changing.
In order to move forward, we must first deal with our history.
Well, joining us now to discuss this week's top stories is Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Boston Globe. Good to have you back, Dante.
Thanks for having me. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. Also with us is Bruce Mohl, editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Good to have you back again, Bruce.
Good to be here.
So let's dive into this week's news, and let's start with the Massachusetts Senate race and how those comments made in Missouri are affecting the race here. Now, as you heard, Missouri Senate candidate Todd Akin said this week that the female body can prevent pregnancies in cases of, quote, legitimate rape, and that comment relit a firestorm of controversy over the Republican Party and women. Now, here's how Massachusetts Democratic Senate candidate Elizabeth Warren tried to spin the moment to her advantage.
The people of Massachusetts have a choice. They can have someone who sometimes talks the right way and sometimes votes the other way, or they can have someone who will always vote to support women.
Now, that put Republican Senator Scott Brown on the defensive.
There's a sense of desperation, and you've seen a lot of the distortions and once again misleading the voters about my position on issues. The facts are the facts. I do have a record, and she doesn't.
So, Dante, let's start with you. What impact do you actually think the Akin gaffe, if that's what we're gonna call it, would have on this Senate race in Massachusetts?
You know, I don't think it ends up pushing the needle too far in one direction or the other. I mean, I do think that Brown, in coming out so quickly in calling for Todd Akin to get out of his race, you know, it was a chance to distance himself from the national Republicans on an issue that matters to a lot of Massachusetts voters. What's striking to me is that both sides, both he and Elizabeth Warren, are analyzing this race in exactly the same way. You know, it's a strongly Democratic state. And the question on the table is, do you believe that Scott Brown is his own man in a way that matters in a really hyper-partisan Senate? Or do you believe that the most important vote that he takes is when he votes for Mitch McConnell as the majority leader at the beginning of the session? Warren's ads, or her radio ads, which, you know, try to link Brown to Todd Akin and to Republicans on other issues, you know, she's telling women voters in particular that, you know, that she believes it's the latter. You know, correspondingly, it's striking how soft the atmospherics are in Scott Brown's TV ads. You know, in down south, you'd see a military guy running for the Senate, and you'd see a lot of stars and stripes and military stuff. And, you know, Brown, it's a much softer sell.
Well, Dante, you mentioned Elizabeth Warren's radio ad. Bruce, I'm going to get to you in a moment, but this is my chance to play it here, because that ad, as Dante said, really seemed to be aimed right at potential women voters.
If the Republicans control the Senate, they decide who sits on the Supreme Court and whether we could lose Roe v. Wade.
So, Bruce, do you think that this sort of wooing that Elizabeth Warren is doing for women voters in Massachusetts will, you know, turn in her favor?
Yeah, I think it's going to be quite effective, actually. I think Brown has been very successful to date, portraying himself as a good guy who's not rigid ideologically. And he handled the Akin controversy as best he could, I think. But just as Brown, when he ran against Coakley, tried to say, I'm the vote that's going to go down there and stop Obamacare, now she's saying, well, yeah, but he's a Republican going down there. I need to go down there and be the Democrat that will stop the Republican machine from taking over on all these sorts of issues. And I think it's an issue that sort of helps her, because she's been hammering issues against a guy who wants to talk about personality. And now she can start to talk about the same sort of thing, really. He goes every which way. He's saying, judges each issue on its merits. She's saying that's not good enough in an environment like that in Washington.
But on the other hand, I do wonder, Bruce and Dante, because Senator Scott Brown took that extra step, some might say, this week of writing an open letter to the Republican National Committee regarding a particular plank that's in the GOP party platform that essentially calls for the ban on all abortions, including in cases of rape or incest. I mean, as you well know, Senator Brown wrote in that open letter, "Even while I am pro-choice, I respect those who have a different opinion on this very difficult and sensitive issue. Our party platform should make the same concession to those of us who believe in a woman's right to choose." Dante, let's hear from you first. I hear what Bruce is saying, that this is opening up a window of opportunity for Elizabeth Warren. But has Senator Brown sort of done well in his continuous call within the context of a Massachusetts Senate race that, you know, he's the guy who's going to be a bipartisan force in the Republican Party?
Well, I think as a matter of political tactics, it works pretty well. I mean, he's at a time when the Republican convention is about to begin and there's this really kind of outlandish controversy enveloping a Senate candidate in his own party. You know, he really has taken some pretty ostentatious steps to distance himself. I guess it runs the risk of, you know, he's sort of stuck with that connection anyway. So it seems to me he's at least managed it relatively, successfully.
Bruce?
I agree. He's managing it. But the reception by the Republican Party to his plea is just sort of go away. We don't care about you. So this idea that he can work both sides doesn't seem to be getting any traction with his Republican side. Is he going to start calling for a lot of these conservative Republicans that Massachusetts Democrats might have problems with to pull back or not run for office? Or what's he going to do? I mean, the logical end game of what he's advocating, it's just an awkward position for him, I think. Mm. How far does he go in criticizing the Republican Party? It's always easy when they just ignore him. Yeah. But if he really starts to lay into them with haymakers, then it might be interesting.
Well, as Dante used the phrase atmospherics earlier, I will use the phrase optics and say the optics on this one are still maybe a little cloudy in Massachusetts. So let's move on to news of MGM Resorts International finally unveiling its plan for an $800 million casino in downtown Springfield. Here's a little tape from the announcement on Wednesday.
We don't want to build a box. We want to build an urban environment. We want people to walk up and down the streets. We want people to shop. We want people to go to the movies and go bowling.
Well, that was Jim Murren, MGM Resorts International Chairman and CEO, who says the casino complex in Springfield would directly employ about 3,000 people and create more than 3,000 jobs or 3,000 more jobs in the region.
And I think about what we could do together to help rebuild a part of Springfield here in downtown, but also to rebuild a community that's fiercely proud, but it's had its share of challenges. We really want to help the city help itself.
Bruce, there's no doubt that this $800 million investment would change downtown Springfield, but is it the right way to go for the long-term revitalization of Springfield?
That's a real tough question to answer, but I got to say, and again, I wasn't on the ground out in Springfield listening to this, but in reading about it and listening to the comments, it sounds like any casino I've been in, it's all designed to keep you inside. It's sort of block out the outside. And the way they've been talking is that they're not going to put a concert venue in the facility. You're going to go across the street to the city's convention center to maybe see some entertainment or what have you. So they are opening the doors, it sounds like, a bit to the city, which I think is a really promising sign.
Dante?
I agree. I mean, I bring a wheelbarrow full of skepticism to this entire enterprise. But I think the Springfield plan has some features that I think we really haven't seen before. You know, we're used to seeing these Las Vegas-style behemoths that, you know, were sort of self-contained environments, and there's a fake volcano outside, and there's a roller coaster on top. And this is something that's significantly different. It uses the existing grid. It uses existing venues. It creates new housing units, supposedly, in a city that has a lot of doesn't have a whole lot of market-rate housing downtown. You know, one sort of – this may be a testament to the state of the gambling industry, which isn't great right now. You know, if the casino environment fails, it becomes a lot easier to redevelop and turn into something else. You don't have to get rid of the fake volcano. You have a one-block casino, but then you have a lot of other normal urban amenities around it. So, you know, it's a positive. Does it still suffer from some of the other problems that people attribute to gambling? Maybe so.
But, you know, around here at Radio Boston this week, one thing that we were sort of wrestling with is do these casino plans, including the one in Springfield that we've seen, live up to the expectations that were initially sort of put out back when we were all struggling with, you know, should casino gambling be made legal in Massachusetts? Because the idea then was that we would have these massive resort-style casinos with the volcanoes and the roller coasters, because those are the things that would actually create the long-term employment and the long-term revenue. I mean, Bruce, do you think that the Springfield plan lives up to that destination-style casino that we were initially promised?
No, I don't think it does. But that may have been the expectation originally, but I think almost every state seems to be exploring casinos. And, you know, we're reaching a point where you just can't have all these destination resorts where everybody goes. So I think we're sort of left with casinos that grab from the surrounding area. It may be a large area, but it's not going to – I don't think people are going to be flying in from, you know, all points to Springfield to gamble. I just don't think that – but I don't think that was a realistic expectation really to begin with. I think our casinos were always going to be – sort of a New England focus, trying to draw from that and trying to keep people that are in Massachusetts from
going to Connecticut. Yeah. Exactly. Dante, your thoughts on that?
I agree completely. You know, the casino debate that we had here in Massachusetts, you know, a couple of years ago, it was as if it was in deep freeze from 1993 when the casino industry was ascendant and there weren't that many places. And you do reach a point of market saturation, which I think we're at right now and is responsible for the problems that Foxwoods and a lot of other casinos have had. And as a result, the configuration of the things that are going to be built here probably ends up looking a lot different from the things that were built in Las Vegas, 10 years ago.
Well, if we can, we've got one more important story to tackle in our Week in Review today, and that is regarding minority police officers in the Boston Police Department. Because Commissioner Edward Davis really wants to, he says he wants to increase efforts to diversify leadership in the Boston Police Department. All 20, I should say, of the department's captains are white, a fact that some say is representative of a serious problem in the history of the department. So Davis wants to change the test by which promotions are conferred upon officers. Now, this is a long-term issue in the BPD. And back in 2010, Jamal Crawford, a Roxbury resident and the publisher and editor of the Blackstonian, sent an open message to Commissioner Davis. So let's listen to that.
In order to move forward, we must first deal with our history. Hiring, firing, promotion, racial preferences shown within the department, all of this needs to be on the table and it all needs to be discussed so we can move forward and begin to heal and repair the relationship between the community and the police department.
Now, Bruce, some would say one way to do that is to have more higher-ranking minority officers in the police force, but the Association of Massachusetts it's Friday, isn't it? But the Massachusetts Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers themselves don't really like Commissioner Davis's plan to change this test in particular. So what's your thought about that?
Well, I think everybody has a suspicion about the tests. A year or so ago, I spent a lot of time looking at the state civil service exam. And Boston's police department was overruled by the State Civil Service Commission on its hiring, just an incredible amount. They were trying to hire someone, the Civil Service Commission would overrule them. It gets really complicated. It gets very expensive to sort of hire through this testing system. It sounds appealing. It sounds objective and like, you know, you're going to solve all the problems with pencil and paper. But it never seems to work out that way. So my suspicion is that a test might be part of the answer, but it's not really going to answer the problem. I think when people are saying put everything on the table, they're talking about getting around a table and trying to reach some consensus about what should happen. But whenever you do that, someone's going to lose and they're going to complain. So it's just a really tough problem. And as you say, it's going to take a long time to resolve.
Dante, Bruce seems to be echoing what the Association of Minority Law Enforcement Officers themselves said, that, you know, just a test was going to do nothing more than, quote, kick the can down the road and not really solve the problem.
You know, we're talking about two questions here. One is the actual substance of the test. I mean, obviously, if you're going to have a test for which the stakes are high, and I guess you could say that, you know, promotion of officers, promotion of captains is something where the stakes are pretty high, it needs to be something that is well matched to the task at hand. And from what I've read about it, I'm certainly no expert on the subject, it certainly sounds as though the test leaves something to be desired. The deeper question, though, is, you know, the anxiety of the test over the test seems to be a proxy for some other broader concerns about the direction of the department. And as we saw from the controversy earlier this year about the Pax Centurion, the police union newsletter that had some pretty offensive comments in it, you know, Black and Hispanic officers look at that as evidence of, you know, a continuing cultural problem or continuing cultural obstacle in their department. It seems as though there's some white officers who also see any change that promotes more diversity as maybe limiting their own options. This is an age-old question. It's something that not just police departments, but a lot of, you know, community institutions of great importance have been struggling with for 50 years now. So, you know, of course, it seems absurd that just changing a test is going to resolve that.
Well, with that leaves us just enough time to bring up our weekly hubbubs. And Bruce, why don't we start with you?
Well, I came across something this week that I thought was interesting. TV stations, local TV stations, are now having to post on the FCC's website the political ads that politicians in their market are running on their stations. And it used to be available, but it was a hassle to get it. But now you can just look it up on the web. And they've been doing this since August 2nd. And we took a look this week, and we found a lot of interesting thing about politicians placing ads. But I was just fascinated with how much an ad costs. This is a locally run ad on TV shows. And Joe Kennedy is booking time on Modern Family, the popular ABC comedy. In October, it costs $30,000 for a 30-second spot.
Locally.
Yeah. And you can look up what the late-night talk show, you know, Jay Leno gets, what does he get? He gets $1,200. And Letterman gets $350, which seems chump change in comparison. And Jimmy Kimmel, who's trying to break into that group, is currently getting $105 to $200 for a 30-second spot. So it's worth checking out just for the fun of checking out what they charge.
Wow. And that's just locally. That's really interesting. Dante, your hubbub for today.
Well, this week the MBTA introduced a live mascot named Charlie after the stylized writer that you see on the Charlie card that's in your wallet. The mascot and the card, of course, are named after the old song Charlie and the MTA. The MBTA, as we all know, or as all of its riders know, has some pretty profound financial problems. But, you know, this is part of a series of low-cost efforts by the MBTA to try to buff up its image and make consumers feel better about riding the service. The problem is maybe that they didn't go quite far enough. Wally, the green monster, the Red Sox mascot who we might be familiar with, is obviously a cartoon character. Charlie, unfortunately, kind of looks like a guy in a top hat. and you know, our story in the Globe this week about him, you know, and passersby who saw him thought that he was Inspector Gadget or maybe the guy from Curious George. So if he mysteriously goes missing at some point this summer, like the Wally the Green Monster did, and turns up at the Apple Store on Boylston Street, you know, people may take a long time to actually notice.
So what I want to know is, if according to the song, is someone going to bring him a sandwich in the middle of the night, right?
I don't know. I hope they bring him exit fare.
Yeah, exactly. He needed a nickel to get out. Okay. Gosh, mine is not quite full of that much levity, but my hubbub is the sad story of A123 Systems, the lithium-ion battery maker from Massachusetts. that first was really hot property in developing the latest technology when it comes to new batteries. Then it needed to get a financial lifeline from a Chinese auto parts company. It got that, but its stock still dipped below $1, which is why NASDAQ has threatened to delist A123 unless they get their acts together. So we're going to keep our eye on that stock. And maybe if I were a Warren Buffett type, this would be the time to buy. But I'm not so sure about that. Anyway, that's my hubbub for today. Dante Ramos, deputy editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And Bruce Moll, editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Thanks so much as well, and have a great weekend.
You too.
Well, listeners, stay with us because coming up next, remembering the BSO leader and Tanglewood founder, Sergei Koussevitzky. In music, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.